Blog Talk Radio.
General Quarters, Security Condition 3.
GQ, Security 3, sir. General Quarters 3, intruder alert. GQ 3, intruder alert.
Hi, good evening and welcome once again to Madame Perry's Salon, the podcast with more celebrities than the inauguration. Hey, this is your host and cruise director, Madame Perry, but you can call me Jennifer Perry. And you know what? I've just got to say thank you to everyone who's been listening, subscribing, downloading, because you've certainly made this a more popular show. You gave me a new audience. I met a woman last week who said that after she found it, she went back to the very beginning, and she's been listening to every single episode so she could hear them in the order, chronological order. And she says she's up to four more shows to get caught up today, and that was pretty cool. So thank you, Mimi, if you're out there listening. I think you're wonderful. And we've had so many fun and different things on recently, fun episodes. Recently we had Ricky Bird. Some of you may know he's a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. He was in, at least he made the Hall of Fame when he was in Joan Jett and the Blackhearts as her guitar player. He's also played with Ian Hunter, Southside Johnny, lots of people. And he's been clean and sober for over 30 years. His latest CD, Clean Getaway, is about that. And he's got a foundation also called Clean Getaway. He goes to treatment facilities and sings and talks about his life and answers questions and gives away CDs. So if you go to his website, you can get a copy of Clean Getaway, and that helps them continue the work they do with people in recovery. Also, we have Pat Duggins. Pat is news director for an NPR station in Birmingham, Alabama, but he's covered every single NASA flight situation, and his book Trailblazing Mars, very interesting. He was a lot of fun too, as well as who else do we have lately? Doug Stenson. He wrote a book called Downstairs at the White House about being 17 years old, accidentally get a job as the intern at the White House, which gave him a ringside seat to Watergate. You can imagine that. And believe it or not, that was one of the most funny shows. We laughed the whole time. But, you know, and coming up next week is going to be Steampunk Night. Now, it's possible we're going to have Professor Elemental. I'm not sure. We're trying to get him into the Wild Wild West Con in Tucson in February. Don't know if he'll be there. I, Madame Perry, I may be doing a panel there. If my panel is approved, my suggestion, but I may be doing a presentation there about broadcasting and so forth and promotion for steampunk folks. But tonight, my guest is somebody she's not a stranger to you. She's been on the show before with other people, and she's visited our last Halloween special. This woman is an award-winning writer of fantasy, science fiction, horror, as well as a few other things. She's won numerous Sir Julius Vogel Awards, Australian Shadows Awards. She lives in a place called the Land of the Long White Cloud in New Zealand, where she conjures up stories for readers of all ages from her office on the porch. But right now, she's here at the Genie's Bottle, known as Madame Perry Salon. So I want to welcome Lee Murray once again. Lee, I think you've got your own little cushion over here, don't you?
Thank you very much. Yes, next to the rack, I think it was, where I sat last time.
Well, yeah, last time you were on the bed of nails. I think that seemed most comfy for you. And again, that was
That's exactly right.
Jasper Bark had the electric chair, which is, you know, I think he feels like that. He feels a little ownership there. He feels that that's his own special place.
It's great to be back, whether I'm sitting on the bed of nails or on the rack.
Well, good. I'm glad to have you here. And so it's evening for us. It's lunchtime tomorrow for you. Lee, I don't know where to begin because you are so well known and so loved and so popular in the fields of, as I said, sci-fi, fantasy, and horror. And I'm almost through with Into the Mist, which is not the kind of book.
Have you been transported into the Yorawera Forest? Have you?
Is that what it's called? I can't pronounce it, but yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Say it again. Yorawera.
Te Urawera. No,
Te
I don't know,
Urawera.
But I think so. Actually, there's a fantastic Maori dictionary online, and if you put any Maori word or term into that dictionary, it'll actually give you the correct pronunciation, which is a fantastic resource, particularly for people learning te reo. And New Zealand's really trying to get to stimulate growth of that language and bring it back because, you know, in the 70s and 80s, it was kind of stifled. People seemed to think that if they wanted to get ahead, they needed to speak English. And, of course, we were losing, you know, this incredible heritage that is inherent in the language. So yes, there's a big push towards te reo, and I think it's important to use it in our stories, particularly if we want to keep that sort of flavour. So, I was very excited when our publisher was happy to keep those terms in. And I know some people find them a little hard when they come across words that they're not familiar with and they haven't seen before, but I do think they add a kind of a cultural richness to a story that, you know, you just... And you know, who else is writing those? It has to be New Zealanders that are writing those stories, otherwise they just get lost. So.
Exactly. I felt exactly the same way. And, yes, as for me, it just tended to add a texture and more of an otherworldliness to the story. Because, yes, I'm definitely transported when I'm in a place where I don't know the names, I don't know the place, but you described them so well. And it makes just adds a bit of a more exotic air to it, which is very cool. And I'm glad to know
you.
An online dictionary, because remember, I'm also reading it. I tried to listen to say what you say, but then again, I've also got my, not only American, but my Southern accent in there with it, so I just want to be sure. So that's a good idea, though, to have that so we can know the word and know how to pronounce it.
Yeah.
So, by the way, folks, if you're listening live and you want to talk to Lee Murray, and I get a feeling a lot of people do, the number is 646-716-9922. That's 646-716-9922, which Blog Talk Radio assures me is a toll-free call in the continental U.S. And if you're outside, believe me, it'll still be worth it to talk to Lee Murray. And, Lee, guess what? Guess what we've also got? We've already got somebody on the line. And this is, I believe this is Sherry calling from San Diego. Sherry, welcome to Madame Perry Salon.
Hey guys! Hi Jen. Hi Lee.
Hi Sherry. How are you?
Rabinowitz.
Hi, I'm fine. Well, I'm better. I was sick. I lost my voice, but it's come back sorta.
Oh, it's so lovely to talk to Sherry. I always enjoy chatting with Sherry. And don't get us started. We tend to wrap it on for a quite
That's
a while.
I'm glad you've got your voice back, Sherry, and I'm glad that you're here with us now. And we're not going to try to wear you out because I want your voice to stay good the rest of the week because you do a great show and you have so many cool people on it. But we're glad you're in here. And as you notice, I've still got your special cushion in here, your favorite one. So I hope you just sit down, make yourself at home. Hope we'll get you some hot tea.
Thank you. With sugar and lemon, please.
Yes, dear, of course. A little Southern comfort if you need it, but... otherwise.
Lee, can you say that name again? Because it's really beautiful.
Which was that? Te Urawera?
The Maori name?
for the that's for the forest, which is on the east coast of New Zealand. Massive big forest, absolutely beautiful and very. It's terrifying as well because it is so big and so dense. And it's a fantastic space. In fact, we have one of our most famous walks through there, the Waikare Moana Walk, which is a several days through the forest. A lot of people come out to New Zealand to hike that. So, that's a name worth remembering.
Is that the place where they shot some of the shows of Xena?
Look, I couldn't tell you because they did a lot of locations for Xena. They did that all over the world, over the country.
All
but they
New
may
Zealand.
Well have done some work in there. Yeah, absolutely. Mm.
Okay, I'm just curious because you know I'm a big fan of Xena.
Yeah, still got a bit of a following. That's for sure. It's a big fandom, certainly.
Yeah.
Now, Lee, I think your most recent book came out this summer. It's Hounds of the Underworld. And this was another one in collaboration with you and Dan Raberts. Am I right?
That's right. Yeah, that's
okay.
Right. And yep. Actually, go on.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, you don't know where to go. Where is, who said this? Jeff Strand, author of Wolf Hunt Field. What does it say? Hounds of the Underworld by Dan Raberts and Lee Murray, okay, listen to this, Sherry, you've probably read this before, a wild and gruesome treat. Okay, you don't say gruesome and treat together very often, but a wild and gruesome treat packed with mystery, action, and dark humor.
it was very kind of Jeff to write that blurb. He's a fantastic writer himself, and his work is very dark comedy and with some very scary moments, and so really kind of him to write that. But we've had so much fun with the series. We've just delivered the second book, actually. And, you know, originally Dan and I thought we would write a novella. We thought we'd have a go at writing together. And we just got carried away. We enjoyed it so much. We had so much fun. And so now we've just delivered the second book, as I say. And the first book, I think, is about 80,000 words, which is pretty standard for a novel. And this one, we've delivered close on 100,000 words because, you know, you're developing the world. The characters are moving along and changing and developing as well. And so it's been quite exciting. So we've got a third book to write, and we're still piecing that together because we're not very good at planning, Dan and I. We tend to have a general idea of where we're going, and then we sort of just head off frantically, and Dan throws a few explosions in and things like that, and then we sort of have to work our way out of them. But it has been a hugely fun experience because we have this relationship which is a bit like a big sister little brother thing, so we do a bit of squabbling between us, and it's sort of quite apparent in the story. So the two siblings squabble throughout the whole story, and there's all the sibling rivalry and tension, and it's something that actually readers said they've liked, that they really recognize that whole, you know, dealing with siblings, and because they know everything about you. They know the kind of pajamas you wore when you were a kid, and, you know, who had what job on a Friday, you know, and didn't get their pocket money or whatever. And so, and it kind of really works for Dan and I because we do have that kind of relationship where we're able to tell each other, hey, you know, you're out of line, or you know, I really liked you did that, and I was really proud of that. And, you know, it's been a nice sort of juxtaposition of those two relationships. So, and we really have had a lot of fun with it. And Raw Dog Screaming Press, which is a boutique press in the United States, are sort of very quirky titles, quite original. And we found a great home there, and they've really looked after us, which has been really great.
Oh, great. So how did you two meet in the first place and get together?
Yeah, now that's a good question, because it is quite a small community, and we're sort of, here in New Zealand, a sort of horror and dark fiction writers. And in fact, I came across Dan about, I think it's about nearly 10 years, not quite 10 years ago now, maybe 8. And we basically ran into each other on an online thread, and Dan was encouraging new writers, and it was something that I tended to do as well. So we got onto this online group, and Dan found a... he found a sort of a thread about the crazy kind of things that kids say, creepy, you know, weird things that kids say. And he said, hey, this could be a cool writing exercise. Why don't we all write some little flash fiction stories along this line, these lines? And some of the stories that came out, you know, within this little group were just fantastic. And we said, oh, we should make a book of this. And the next thing you know, Dan and I were making a book out of it, and the money went to charity. And so it kind of grew from there. We had so much fun. So we've done things like we've run a national convention programming together, the two of us, a couple of times now, and we've done a couple more anthologies. We've done some short story national competition prize, you know, awards and that sort of thing. We've judged those. So we've done a lot of work together now over the years, and it's just, we just click. So it's really rather nice. We both do our own individual writing, but it's nice to have a collaborator who you get on with, and you sort of have, we like the same kind of things. So that's kind of where it's come from.
But you also have a good enough relationship where you can be honest with each other about things that do and don't work for you. And I think that's very important.
Yeah, and I think the thing, I had this conversation with Sherry once, and I think with collaboration, you're writing something different. It's not something you would write on your own. You've got someone else to bounce ideas off, and someone else doing a bit of research, and they have a different perspective and a way of looking at things. And also, Dan writes the broody sort of bad boy character, and I write the uptight little Chinese girl, somewhat like ourselves. And because of that, we have these quite different perspectives. We come to the story at different angles. And so what you get as a result is something completely different that you wouldn't write on your own. Although, you know, we still write chapters about, we do have these very distinct voices for our characters. The story as a whole would not be what it is if we wrote it on our own. So it's like having a third person in the room, if you like, when you're having this other author, which is Dan and Lee, or the other editor, which is Dan and Lee, in the room. So it's really rather exciting. The sad thing is that, you know, you think with a collaboration you're writing half the book. So instead of writing 80,000 words, you're writing 40,000 words, and you think that should take half the time, but unfortunately it seems to take double the time, because with all the research and the discussion and the no, we can't do that, that's not going to work, it ends up taking twice as long. So anyone who thinks I'll go in with someone and we'll share the work, it doesn't quite work like that. Ends up being way, way more. So, yeah.
What do you do when one of you really, really feels strongly about something or keeping something in or out and the other one totally disagrees?
Well, you know, I'm the big sister in this relationship, right? So what I say goes. You know, it's very Lucy Van Pelt here. You know, I'll just take his blankie away, and we just have a wee squabble and then we agree. You know, I think that's kind of how it works. There isn't any malice in it at all. So, yeah.
Okay, all right, Lucy Van Pelt. I like that. Yes, so that's good.
I do have the odd crabby day.
but just to back it up, when you talk about your personalities and all, and just see, I don't believe you could be. How did you describe it just a moment ago?
the little Chinese girl who's uptight, the little scientist.
Yes. See, I don't see how we can kind of put that together with things where it says some of the stuff that you've come up with that just really grabs onto people. Okay, here's one. Here's the thing: is I want to read some of your reviews and blurbs. But yeah, I don't want to give anything away. But here's one thing. God, come on, you can't write some of this stuff. I mean, I'm reading, and then all of a sudden somebody's just, you know, two guys are just kind of school friends, and they're tramping along, which is, I guess, what tramping means, you know, like hiking or exploring and stuff. And then all of a sudden, they take it, you know, they're asleep. One wakes up and the other one goes looks for his buddy, and then half of him's gone. Okay, come on. Where's the little uptight Chinese girl scientist in that? Okay, the guy is half gone. You can't tell me. And then this guy's taken off running for all he's worth. Okay.
I think we do borrow from our own lives and when we're writing. So when I'm writing Penny in The Hounds of the Underworld, you know, my professional training was as a scientist. I was a research scientist by profession. And so, you know, I use that, although it's 20 years old now, but I do use that and draw on that. I do have a Chinese background that I draw on. My mother is Chinese, born in New Zealand, third generation, but still, you know, we have that element in my family life. And yes, I'm a serious perfectionist. So those kind of things, that, you know, I'm the eldest of four children. So those are easy things for me to write because they, you know, it makes it easier because I know those things to be authentic. And Dan, a bit the same. He has a Maori background. He works in the security industry. He's not the bad boy that Matthew is, but he does. You know, you draw on these things in order to create an authentic character. Now with Into the Mist, which was set in the forest. You know, obviously I didn't quite run into anything like that in the forest, but I did do a lot of running and hiking in the forest for many years. I'd spent, you know, I've run 25 marathons over the years, and a lot of those in New Zealand are run in the trails. And sometimes you can be on a trail, and if there are, you know, a few hundred people on a marathon run, you might not see anybody for an hour. You know, you could be running on a trail all by yourself in the middle of the forest with, you know, nobody else around but the birds and the river and whatever. So it can be quite an isolating experience, especially when you're at, you know, I don't know, 37 kilometres or 25 miles or something, and you're just on your own and you're really tired. So, you know, I could draw on those things to, when I was writing Into the Mist. And I think that real experience is something that does really feed into your writing and make it real, and I think that really does help. So when I say I'm a little uptight Chinese girl, well, perhaps that wasn't the authentic me that I was borrowing from when I wrote Into the Mist, but it certainly is when I write Hounds of the Underworld. So, and I think this is something we do. When I work with children, I always say, you know, they say, well, what's your job like as a writer? And I tell them I can come to work in my pajamas if I want to, which they always like that idea. And the other side of it is that I tell them, you know, I steal things, you know, I steal ideas from places, I eavesdrop and I borrow conversations from people, you know, I exaggerate, I make things bigger. I mean, you know, our little tuatara is the size of a loaf of bread, and Into the Mist, I made him the size of a garden shed. So, you know, it's quite, you know, that's the sort of thing we do as writers. And so anywhere we can make it authentic by borrowing, eavesdropping, you know, stealing ideas, those sorts of things, I think that they contribute to making a richer narrative.
Do you ever get inspiration really from eavesdropping or lines or bits of dialogue? Because, you know, even David Mamet, you know, the playwright, says he gets a lot of his best stuff from eavesdropping on people, a lot of his best lines.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't obviously write that conversation verbatim, but you would take elements or aspects of the voice and that kind of thing. You do need to be an observer of life, I think, as a writer or a screenwriter or a filmmaker, any of these creative activities. You do need to be quite observant, I think, you know, and look at things. Sorry, what was that, Sherry?
I said Agatha Christie did that. She used to be very sneaky in a way. She would, like, have pen and paper in her purse and very quietly write notes and then stick it back in her purse. And then
yes, well, it's very
she
dangerous now with cell
the,
phones.
Yeah, but they didn't have that. And then she would write in, they showed her diary on a special about Agatha on PBS here in the States.
Oh.
And one of the things that they showed was her diary, her secret diary, they called it. And it was so funny. It was like there was a plot line for a book. There were notes that she eavesdropped on, and there was bulbs for her garden, like, on the same page.
Oh, isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. I think that's a little bit like Da Vinci and his notes with his scientific notes and his artistic notes and writings all on one page. He used to do that too, didn't he? So it's obviously something. I won't show you. I'm looking at my desk now, and there's papers all over the place, but there's no order. So perhaps my problem is I need to have everything in one page. That might be more helpful.
I'm more like maybe, you than Agatha Lee.
I noticed that when, and I'm sure I'm not the only person who's told you this, as I found out, as I'm reading Into the Mist, I feel like I'm watching, it's very similar to watching a movie or a film. And I kept thinking, this just lends itself so beautifully to a film, the way everything goes, the way you describe things, where we go from scene to scene, and the characters that you draw. And then I read the review from Greg Beck that says cinematic. It starts off cinematic and evocative. I'm going, okay, cinematic right there, first line. Yes, that's exactly what I see. Cinematic and evocative. Into the Mist is a tension-packed expedition into primordial terror. Murray's writing had me feeling the damp of the forest, seeing the mist curling through the fern fronds, and sensing the danger lurking there. Ancient myths, military men, and scientists placed in remote primordial locations. It had all the right ingredients for me and didn't disappoint for a moment. Liam Murray's an author to watch. So do you get a sense? Did you feel that way when you were writing it? Did you see it as a film unfolding?
Well, it would be nice. I didn't sort of see it as a film in my head, but yes, it would be fantastic, and lots of people have said that. I think partly because it's an ensemble cast, if you like. So it's a mosaic story in the sense that it's told from lots of different people's point of view. And because of that, which is a little bit what you do in a film, you know, you cut to someone else's perspective, or you see it from one of the characters' points of view. And I think that that's perhaps the reason why. And because this is a technique, of course, when you're doing is show not tell, which is basically you put yourself in the character's head and you narrate the story that way. So I think perhaps that is why it seems cinematic, and a lot of that internal thought doesn't get on the page with screenwriting, for example. So the filmmaker does that with his filmmaking techniques. So that's a completely different medium for me, and I don't know enough about it. But if anyone knows how to get into Taika Waititi's house and put my book on his bedstand, that would be great. I'd be fine with that. because he isn't actually banging my door down for a film option, unfortunately. But he would be, you know, we do have a fantastic film industry here in New Zealand. And, you know, with the films like The Rings and you know, Avatar and all of the, a lot of those films are filmed here because we have this great film community, a centre of excellence, if you like, particularly in the capital. And so, yeah, it would be really, really nice to get it into film. But it hasn't happened yet. So we'll just keep our fingers crossed. You never know. But it was very nice of Greg Beck to give the book such a wonderful review, particularly coming from a writer of his caliber. And Greg, he's Australian, he actually is married to a New Zealander, so he does know the New Zealand bush. So it was lovely for me to hear him say that it really did conjure up, you know, being in the forest in New Zealand for him. And he writes very edgy, pacey thrillers. So to get that endorsement, oh, honestly, I danced around the room when I got that endorsement. It's very, very, very kind of him. He writes fantastic. I'm a big fan of his work, so it was extremely kind of him to do that for me. And yes, interestingly, I did write an article for the Australian Times some time ago because other people have said to me, Into the Mist needs to be a movie. And I actually sent a note to Greg and asked him about that because why did he call it cinematic and what was it about it that made it cinematic for him? And he just, the fact that he said, again, it was the fact he could walk through, he could feel like he was actually in the place, in the mm-hmm. bush. But interestingly, he said he's had a number of his titles, you know, potentially optioned for film, and it never actually happens. So there's a big step from being optioned for film and actually having the film put into production. And, of course, there's a huge, huge organisational effort to get those sort of things to translate from the book format to the screen. So, you know, while I'm hopeful, you know, I think that it's probably a bit of a pipe dream. So, but you never know. You never know. I'll just keep putting my feelers out there.
I don't know about that. You know, I've got, I don't know if you know, I'm an entertainment publicist, and I've got a client whose book was sold. The film rights were purchased before she even got it published. In fact, Sherry
Sherry's
interviewing her on Thursday.
Oh,
is that right, Sherry?
Wow. I must check that one out.
Yep.
Yeah.
Sorry, my throat just kind of gave out a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry, baby. Yeah, her name is Jennifer Irwin, and Sherry's interviewing her Thursday. Now, of course, it's, you know, she lives in Los Angeles, and so that, you know, made it possible for her to, you know, it was somebody she already knew, and she was passing her manuscript to a few people to look at and go over, say, you know, how does this sound? How does that sound? You never know. And I'll tell you what, though, when you listen, when you think about Stephen King, I don't know if you have this TV show in New Zealand yet, but there was a brand new show that started. It's kind of, it's hard to say if it's like a comedy or a drama or what else, but it's called Claws. And Stephen King is totally enamored of this show.
Hmm.
Have you heard of it, Lee?
I haven't seen that one myself. It's
well, let's put it this
we're
way.
We're usually a little bit behind in New Zealand television, and so I can't say I've seen it here, but it must be something I need to check out, clearly.
Well, let me put it this way. Imagine Claws comes from the fact that part of the action takes place in a nail salon, you know, with very exotic
okay.
artificial nails being done. And the owner of the salon, she doesn't like this, but for certain reasons, she's having to allow this guy or this group of people in the local, it's hard to tell if this takes place in South Georgia or Florida, but the Dixie Mafia, if you've ever heard of them.
Oh, wow. Yeah, wow.
Dixie
that
Mafia
sounds like
is
a great combination for a story.
Yeah, the Dixie Mafia is laundering money through this woman's nail salon as well as a methadone clinic. So, I just have to.
Wow, I didn't know there was so much money in nails, clearly.
And so Stephen King is on Twitter all the time saying, this is the best show going. I love this show. And it's funny. Once I saw that, I started trying to pay attention to it and watching it, and it is funny. We'll have to send that to you. So you need to keep in step with Stephen and then have him notice. You might want to just go ahead and send him a couple of books, but I'm not your publicist, so you do what you want to do. So.
Yeah, I'm already getting a bit of a reputation as a stalker there, Jennifer. I don't know. Maybe that's something, you can get arrested for that, right?
If they catch you, yeah. But if you're so far away, they can just catch you. Other than that, it's no big deal. You know, it's just kind of,
You're in another country. I don't think you're going to get in trouble.
You heard it here, folks.
You heard it there.
You're
yeah.
far.
Well, I think my husband here was reminding me of some of the other nicknames for the Dixie Mafia. I was thinking of the Cornbread Cosa Nostra. But anyway, we'll go on from there. Hounds of the Underworld. I want to get back to that since that's one of your most, since that is your most recent book. Am I correct?
Yeah. Actually, it's going to be, I think it's going to be until about February of next year. And then the Into the Mist series, actually, interestingly, the publisher is just about to close its doors potentially. And it's unfortunate in publishing. It's very sad. It's really rather sad because it's a fantastic little publishing house. But I've been really excited because, you know, as soon as it was announced, I had three or four publishers come to me and ask for the rights for the books. So it will be that series will be coming out next year, even though the little publisher has closed. So watch the space. I'll be able to make some announcements in the next month, and we should be able to see that Tane McKinnon series come out next year, and the whole three books should come out before the end of 2018.
I love the name, Raw Dog Screaming Press. I mean, that's a beautiful name.
Oh, it is. It's a fantastic little press, actually. Really great. And they also have the Dog Star Books imprint, which is the sort of youth imprint. And great little press. They're doing extremely well. They've picked up a couple of Bram Stoker Awards, I think two in the last 2 years, so each year they've won two, so that's going to be a hard act to follow for them this year. Lovely little house. They just a really nice family feel there, and such quirky off the wall titles, a little bit different. And they're risk takers. They do poetry as well as youth stories, and they're just risk takers. They don't mind taking a risk on something that's just that little bit off the wall and not, you know, not your average story, which, you know, we've been very excited to be part of that group, and some fantastic writers in there. Absolutely, if you get a chance to check them out, Raw Dog Screaming Press, they've got some fantastic titles.
I will be sharing the links and information on Raw Dog Screaming Press on all of my social media right after the show, and also on how to get the books. Hounds of the Underworld, but I also ask because it says Hounds of the Underworld, The Path of Ra, Book 1. So will this be Book 2 that we're going to get on this, or what are we?
Yeah, you'll get Book 2, I think, comes out in about June of 2018. So, and then we're working on the third book, obviously. So, yeah. That's right. So that's the next one. But it has been we've already sent that one off. So we're working on the third one now. There's quite a delay with publishing. There's a long lead time, unfortunately, and it's tough on readers who are just hanging out there waiting for that next book. And in the meantime, I've been writing a few short stories and been working on some anthologies. Been putting together this last week with some colleagues of mine, a showcase anthology called Te Korero Ahika, which is kind of like keep the home fires burning, if you like. That's a Māori expression, and it's a showcase anthology of speculative work by New Zealand writers. So we're trying to sort of get ourselves out into the world, and we'd love for the rest of the world to see, you know, what kind of writing, what fantastic writing is being done down here in New Zealand. So most of these stories have a really New Zealand flavour, which I'm quite excited about. And the other anthology just put together with actually one of my the same colleagues is Grace Bridges, was a collection of youth stories by our New Zealand secondary school students. I think this is the sixth year that my colleague Piper Mejia and I have been running this, which is a sort of two national competitions for students in writing and poetry, and always speculative science fiction, fantasy, horror. It's always so uplifting and inspiring. We get these are our, you know, the writers of the future, so it's really wonderful to work with them. And so every year we put together two little anthologies of the children's work, the best work from the competitions. Huge amount of work. We get 500 or 600 stories in, and we give every student individual feedback. So that is a massive undertaking. And just recently we just put out the last anthology of the year. So those sorts of, I do manage to keep myself busy in between the books. someone told me yesterday that I was a pathological volunteer, and I think that's probably not too far from the truth. I do find those sorts of things extremely inspiring. They're just so uplifting to work with young people, and some of their stories just incredible. I have really, really enjoyed it. And although it does take me away from my own writing, you know, it's fun, and I just always like to give back something a little bit back to the community. They've really looked after me. So, you know, you do have to sort of put a little bit back from time to time. So that's the other thing that's been keeping me busy in between time.
I was going to say, by the way, if you're listening live and you want to talk to Lee Murray, the number is 646-716-9922. That's 646-716-9922. You know, I also wanted to see, I was looking at a website called Fantastic Fiction, and the feature on Hounds of the Underworld, and I like this paragraph where it says, Hounds of the Underworld blends mystery, near future noir, and horror. Set in New Zealand, is the product of a collaboration by two Kiwi authors, one with Chinese heritage and the other Maori. This debut book in the Path of Ra series offers compelling new voices and an exotic perspective on the detective drama. And I like that. You know, that's exciting. But also, too, the cover. This is a gorgeous, of course, Into the Mist, all your books have great covers. But Hounds of the Underworld, yes, you do feel like you're stepping into this world. You know, you can look at it and tell you're going to be into a crime noir and a bit of a horror and definitely an underworld. So,
yeah. Oh, look, we've been so lucky. Well, I have been. Certainly Into the Mist was the cover designer there was Dean Salmed from the UK, an award-winning cover designer. And so that's been, you know, really, I was just so excited to get a cover by Dean. And he's gone on to wonderful things. And then this particular cover with the Raw Dog Screaming Press for Hounds of the Underworld is done by Daniel Serra, an Italian artist. And he's winning awards all over the place. Just, I think he won the World Fantasy Award just recently for a cover design. So just, you know, anyone is getting a cover from Danielle, and it's sort of done some Stephen King and some Clive Barker. So, you know, in the genre, he's really making a mark for himself. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so when we got delivered this cover, which is very crime noir, isn't it? And with that, I don't know, very seedy undertone, it was lovely. And we looked at it, And, you know, we were so taken aback because it's so beautiful. And yet it isn't Auckland as we know it, which is where the story is set. And so Dan and I were like both so taken aback because it was such a wonderful vision of the future of Auckland, and yet it wasn't what we recognized as being Auckland. And so for the both of us, it was like, oh, wow. I mean, oh, wow. Oh, wow. You know, it was mixed reactions because we've been so excited. The response to the cover has been wonderful, and I really do feel it is a fabulous fit. And it's almost as if Danielle has offered something different to the story and the setting of the story by giving us this image, because it is not what we expected, and yet now that we see it, it is kind of what we should have expected. Does that make sense? It's as if he conjured up what we needed to have in our mind already, and because we'd come from New Zealand where we know Auckland and that's where we set the story, but we don't know Auckland in the future, he'd kind of done it. He'd done something that we hadn't quite done ourselves. So it's really been rather wonderful. And the reaction has been huge. You know, we're very excited about that. And it was really wonderful because I don't imagine he's a cheap artist to get now. And Raw Dog Screaming Press are very kindly invested in this really fantastic cover. So we've been very pleased with it. Yeah, they say you can't judge a book by its cover, but oh, I do think it makes such a difference to the discoverability of the book.
What a cover. Yeah, what a cover does, you know, what a cover does. And sounds like it was a bit of, the way you describe it, like almost a bit of unusual, a certain level of synchronicity where it might not have been exactly what you expected or asked for, but it's like somebody reached into the story and into the subconscious.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
some kind of synchronicity. That is exactly how to say it, how to put it. You're dead right, Jennifer. It just fits. It fits well. So.
You know, the kind of thing like where if you want something but you order something else and then the server brings you what you were really thinking about, but then order it's like, what are they reading my mind kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, and from the other side of the world as well, you know. So it's quite uncanny, isn't it? Sometimes I think things just work out the way they're supposed to. So
yeah, it's almost like a Carl Jung, like a Jungian collective mind, but yet it wasn't on the top of your mind, but it was somewhere. I like that. I like those kind of connections.
Oh, and I think a part of it is perhaps just the way Jennifer Barnes at Raw Dog Screaming Books must have sent a script of some sort or some information to Danielle about what she wanted to see. And I think that perhaps her interpretation was a good one. You know, she obviously knows the market and she knew the book and what would appeal. And so, you know, sometimes it's just how that's interpreted. So she's been, you know, a fantastic advocate for the book, and I think that might have made a difference. She had a vision that translated, you know, that she passed on, because we didn't have much input into it at all. We said, this is Auckland. We sent a few pictures and said, you know, and we've said it in the future, and it's just, you know, we weren't very helpful. So, yes, they did actually, you know, step into the story and try and you know, and I don't think that a lot of people realise that in general the cover art is not the writer's decision, it's the publisher's decision. And it is really just a courtesy that they involve, you know, that they involve the writers, and most publishers do, but it isn't a given. And getting something that fits your vision is really a miracle, you know, because we all have such different interpretations that even when you come to a story, we all bring our own baggage to a story, and you know, some things resonate for people that don't resonate for others because we've had this particular history. You know, for New Zealanders, Into the Mist was great because it's, you know, we know this forest, we recognise these places. Mm-hmm. But for someone else, it's quite different. So, you know, we all bring our experience to a story, and anyway.
Yeah, I like that. To sort of like, you know, when the first time I ever saw music videos, and these were just some simple ones done that were back in the 70s, you know, I would think, well, yeah, some of these were good, but then again, I think each it's like a little story. Each person interprets the song in a different way for how it resonates with them. You know, in the same way you're talking about coming to the book with what resonates with you, how you see something or someone. If you know, a lot today, these days, a lot of authors are creating their own short films or short videos of their books in a way to, or an attempt to try to sell it as a production or to a filmmaker or film house. Have you ever had people act out scenes or create little short videos for you? And do you think about that?
My focus is on producing a good, writing a good story and engaging my readership. So, you know, because I don't know enough about film to know that business. So I think, you know, I think a lot of writers feel that when their story becomes a film and someone picks it up to make it a film, that's a completely different medium. And mm-hmm. you need a completely different set of skills. And so often you'll see that the person who writes the book isn't the person necessarily who writes the screenplay. And I definitely learned this when, you know, Cherry will remember that The Thief's Tale won a Sir Julius Vogel Award a couple of years ago, which was part of the Refuge Collection, a charity horror collection for sanctuary refugees. And that particular title, we decided we would make into a screenplay to see if it would make a good short film. And Dan, my collaborator on Hounds of the Underworld, it's all very incestuous. Dan is actually a screenwriter, and he's come through the theatre industry and the film industry. Worked for a long time for Weta Workshop people, the people who do the Hobbit, the Lord of the Rings films. So Dan mm-hmm. said, I'll do a treatment on it. So he went and did the screenplay. And, you know, it was a fascinating experience for me because I am not a screenwriter. I'm a writer, but I'm not a screenwriter, which is a completely different thing. And Dan was saying, explaining it to me, the way that, you know, even the dialogue has to change a little because you have to get it in the dialogue, what you can't get all around, you know, what you can't see or the internal thought and those kinds of things. It's quite a different process. And I do have some colleagues here in New Zealand who are in this sort of acting film community. And yes, they do. There are places in New Zealand here where you can take your work and you can have it, you can have a group of actors act it out and workshop it to see how you could write it better as a screenplay. But like I say, it's quite a different experience and quite a different process for writing screenplay than it is for writing a story as a novel in a more traditional sense. So I have to admit to knowing very little about it, and it was quite surprising and very energizing to see your work being translated into a treatment for screen, but quite different as well, you know. So it's a little bit alien to me, because it's how you translate that very traditional format into something that is very visual. You don't have the opportunity to see what the character is thinking, so how do you get that onto the screen? So it's exciting and also a bit alien to me as well at the same time. So I admit I know very little about it.
This it doesn't sound that way to me.
Yeah.
Do you visualize though, like when you in creating scenes, do you visualize it like you would a film or like you were watching it on TV?
I think most writers would do that at some point. They talk to themselves as well, and yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think most writers will do a bit of that. I mean, there's a part of, you know, and then sometimes the characters talk back and won't do what they're told. I think you've had that experience, haven't you, Sherry, where your characters talk back and they say, no, I won't.
Sherry had to leave us. She said her throat was starting to bother, so she had to leave us. But I know she's probably still listening. But yes, we are thinking about you, Sherry. yeah.
I think
not being a fiction writer. I don't have that being a fiction writer. As a band leader, definitely. Yeah, when you think somebody's going to do something and they don't. But other than that, no. What does
Now characters have their own sort of persona and motivation. So you'll be writing a story and you think it's going to go one way, and then your character will basically say to you, no, I wouldn't do that, or I wouldn't say that, and then you have to come back to the original motivation and the plan and say, well, actually, that's right, and go with what your character demands of you. But sometimes we make that mistake, and they do. They can be quite verbal. It's very annoying.
See, I've heard so many writers say that, read so many, and yet, I never was sure. I was always afraid to, I think I would be afraid to say that, because I'm not even sure if after next year my insurance would cover the kind of response I would get if I said something like that.
Oh, dear. Well, you're the one who recommended that I stalk Stephen King. I'm just keeping that. I'm just making sure that everybody knows that.
Okay, let me put it this way. You haven't read my actual essays, and this is, you could call it creative nonfiction, but I will have to share some of those with you, and then we'll see. Then we'll see what you think.
I'd be very interested.
See? Yeah, or maybe if you're having trouble sleeping sometimes. But here, I wanted to ask you about your books. You've got so many, because I only have such a little time left with you, and you've been so generous with your time. With all the fantastic things, The Thief's Tale, Into the Mist, Misplaced, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
You also, every now and then, have something like Dash of Reality and Battle of the Birds that seem so, and maybe I'll let you describe this to listeners the way you want to describe those books or the genre or the style, but it seems like that's almost like a bit of a little vacation for you, or maybe a palate cleansing if you're a food tester.
Yeah, that's
or
actually
chef.
A good way to put it. But actually, A Dash of Reality is just a bit of a fun romp. It's a beach read. It's about running marathons and a chick lit, really, and great fun. And in fact, that's kind of where I learned a lot of techniques. So it's not my favorite of my books, but it's 10 years since I wrote that book. And so a great sort of learning curve, and not, just a bit of fun. It's great fun, a really fun story. So that was that one. And Battle of the Birds is a children's book. It's middle grade. It's actually fantasy. I wrote it for my daughter, and we were living in Wisconsin at the time, in Madison, and I kind of missed home. I was absolutely desperate to be home and in New Zealand, and she was too. So I wrote the story about a little girl who falls asleep on an effigy mound in Wisconsin and wakes up in New Zealand, which would be wonderful because we were both dreaming of doing that. except for something goes wrong and she ends up back in New Zealand 1,000 years early, right in the middle of the war between the birds who fly and the flightless birds. And in New Zealand, we have a massive number of flightless birds. So so that's kind of where that story came along. It's been a great starter book, and it's done so well. Sold lots of copies. Kids love it. I'm very proud of that work. It's one of my first works. And Misplaced is completely different again. Misplaced is a young adult book, and I kind of wrote that one for closure. One of my dear friends in France, Florence, she went missing, and she's never been found. And so I kind of wrote that story as a way of working through the fact that I lost a friend and I have no idea where she is. So Misplaced is about a boy whose mother goes missing. Yeah, and he doesn't know what's happened to her, and it's the whole process he goes through while that happens. And it's actually, unfortunately, something that happens more often than you think, where people go missing and they aren't found. Mm-hmm. And how do you reconcile that? So in some ways it's probably one of my darkest works, and yet it's a young adult work. And I set it here in the Bay of Plenty, which is where I live now. You mentioned that my office looks office from the porch, but I now have an office that looks at a cow paddock. So I'm back in the Bay of Plenty where Misplaced was set. But most of my work is science fiction or fantasy. I do, but those ones are a little bit different, as you say. And I also write some picture books, and so I can't decide, basically. It's a girl's prerogative, right? We can change our minds.
All right. Lee, this has been so much fun. It just always seems the time goes by so fast when
it does.
You're in Madame Perry's salon. It's just like, it seems like an hour is a long time, but then all of a sudden it's like it's gone. But I just want to thank you so much. It's gone. I just want to thank you so much. Thanks to our pal, Sherry Rabinowitz, host of the show Chatting with Sherry, for joining us tonight. That was fun to have her here. And I just want to say, go. By the way, if I responded inappropriately, because I didn't get the last sentence you said, because my dogs, I think they got into a fight over a treat. So I had my own hounds of the underworld here. So I just kept hoping if I could still hear you talking, like, I think hopefully you didn't hear them when it stopped. But yeah, I've got my own hounds of the not the underworld under the desk. There. So
it's been fabulous being with you, Jennifer.
It's been a delight.
Thank you for having me.
And I want folks, Lee Murray, author of sci-fi, fantasy, horror, all kinds, and then some other things that are surprising. Lee, I'm going to take you out on the show at the end with a song. Bye, Lee. Bye, Yola.